Welcome to another exciting episode of the NIDS View, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we are advancing peace, promoting stability, and helping you to think deterrence. Each week, we will discuss and analyze a recent topic and provide insight to how it affects our national deterrence. The view of the hosts and guests are their own. We hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome back to a great episode of the NIDS View. Of course, I'm Adam Lowther, along with Curtis McGiffin. Jim Petrosky is actually on an Alaskan vacation right now. And so Curtis and I thought, what better way to celebrate Jim's absence than just to go ahead and do a podcast on our own?
We're cutting out the middleman.
And cutting out the middleman. You know, it's what can you say, you know?
What can you say?
So, you know, it's been an interesting week, and there's been a lot, a lot that's been out in the news. But one of the, you know, there was one article that actually kind of struck us as something worth talking about. And of course, you know, Hal Brands, a professor at Johns Hopkins, he wrote an article in Bloomberg Opinion called "Welcome to the New Nuclear Age, It's Even More Chaotic." And the article talks about what, you know, sort of the nuclear age we're in looks like and the impact that the Trump administration is having on it. And so I thought, you know, Curtis, this is, we've talked about Hal Brand's articles before because we often disagree. But this, you know, also this article brings up sort of some of the key highlights for those of us who think about nuclear strategy and deterrence. And so, you know, it's a great article to sort of give us a segue into these sort of important topics that we like to discuss. Now, with that in mind, Curtis, I know you, this was an article you brought to the table, and so I wanted to give you the first shot at talking, giving us your thoughts.
Well, thanks, Adam. You know, we've had Hal Brand's pieces on this podcast before. I am amongst the many things that I like to have my hands in with regard to nuclear deterrence and strategy is the grand strategy side of things as well. And Hal Brands is one of our nation's probably top-tier grand strategy thinkers. And so I really like to read his things and learn from the academic side of Hal Brands. I tend to get frustrated with the political side of Hal Brands because he doesn't try to be bipartisan or apolitical. He's clearly on one side or the other when it comes to topics that involve President Trump and the Trump administration's plural. And so, and that is not why we're talking about this article today. We're not a political or commentary podcast, but what it always strikes me because some of his really good analysis is sort of tainted by his, I don't know, his disagreements.
Anti-Trumpism.
Yeah, I guess. And I don't, again, I'm not trying to pick political sides one over the other. I did not detect anti-Bidenism in any of his articles during the previous 4 years. So one can only draw those sorts of conclusions. But with that being
said.
Or
you know what you can do? You know what you can do, Curtis?
Yes.
You just go to the Federal Election Commission's website and you type in an individual's name. And you can see exactly who they've donated to, so you know exactly who they support.
Right.
That's
right.
That's something I often do. So gives it away. There's no keeping it quiet.
I don't only because I don't think about it. It's just not something that jumps to me. But the crux of this piece, Adam, that I think was really worth our time here is you know, as in the astute academic that Dr. Brands is, he lays out five key trends that challenge the time-honored notions of nuclear strategy and stability. This is the wheelhouse of NIDS, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And so
for sure.
That's why this article was so meaningful to me. While I disagree with a lot of it, it's still worth talking about. And so let me just quickly review the five items so that our audience can get an introduction here. And that is, he says that the first key trend is that great power nuclear rivalry has returned. And it is a three-player game. Okay, we'll break each one of these up in how we might agree or disagree. The second is new technologies make deterrence more tenuous and make surprise attacks more feasible. The third trend is that deterrence is is that existing arms control architecture is crumbling, and I think that's pretty apparent out there. And the fourth one is, the non-proliferation regime is being strained in multiple regions. Okay, let's talk about why that is. And then finally, and this is the kicker, is he says, as the U.S. becomes more erratic and unilateral, it jeopardizes the arrangements that have provided great power, peace, and international stability for generations. Now, this is the partisan comment, in my opinion. This is a shot across the Trumpian bow. And clearly, Dr. Brands does not approve of any perturbing of the 80-year status quo that he presumes to have been a clear winner with regard to how the world is laid out. While I don't maybe disagree that we've been a clear winner, what I do want to offer is that the world has changed. And what worked for the last 80 years may not work for the next 80 years. And if we're not willing to at least consider and look at possible courses of action with those changes, you're going to be locked into always looking backwards and never looking forwards. And so this is something that I thought was of particular interest. So, Adam, I don't know if we'll have time to go through all five of these. I hope we can, because some of these are very meaningful in just sort of understanding how he sort of looks at these things. But I thought maybe we could go back and forth on these five things just to sort of give our thoughts on this, if that sounds
good to
you. All
right, well, you kick it off with the first, and then I'll pick it up from there.
So he says that again, the first one is that great power nuclear rivalry has returned, and it's a three-player game. Okay, so this is a classic lesson in the duh. We are clearly comfortable with the idea that great power rivalry has returned, and that it is what is driving a lot of our decisions going forward, diplomatically, militarily, economically. Especially as we've seen in the last three or four administrations. But great power competition, I argue, has really existed since 2001. And so for this to be a surprise, 24 years later, at least to anybody who's not paying attention, should be, have an extra cup of coffee here. The real start of this competition started a week after 9/11, when China was allowed into the World Trade Organization. And since then, China has experienced exponential economic growth, which has translated into lots of 7% spending in their defense budgets and a huge, massive expansion in their nuclear capabilities. Whereas America has seen its national debt go from somewhere about $8 trillion in those days to almost $38 trillion today, while our economy has grown, not nearly at the percentage that China's economy grew. And so these kinds of aspects have triggered a lot of rivalry. We're having to do some major mitigation, while China is still in enjoying some measurable amount of growth. We can argue on the edges about, whether how their economics are, whether or not they are really you know, a false economy or a real economy or these sorts of things. But it's hard not to argue that that they are the second largest economy in the world. If you take in exchange rates, if you take in purchase power parity, they are the largest economy in the world. And so this has created a great power rivalry. And you add into that 2001, Putin took over in 1999. He starts getting his feet under him in 2001. And so that's when he sort of realizes, I need to renew the Russian ban. I want to put the band back together, so to speak. The near abroad is a challenge, and we see him dealing with Chechnya and other issues going forward and beginning to revitalize his nuclear enterprise and try to diversify his economy and so forth and so on. So while Russia is nowhere near the economic power China is, it is vastly larger in nuclear power with regard to weapons. And so it still is considered to be a superpower in this regard. Where I want to draw a distinction with Dr. Brands is that I don't believe, Adam, that it's any longer a thruel or a three-peer problem. The U.S. the Strategic Posture Commission came out in late 2023 that really brought to the attention of this idea that they might coordinate and collaborate against the West together. And so you really have to think of China and Russia in the question of deterrence, maybe not in economies and diplomacy, but in the question of deterrence, you have to really think about how do you deter them together. I think they are now one body. And so we are back to a duel with regard to deterrence. It just looks different than it did in the Cold War. Thoughts?
It's interesting that you say that. The thing I thought Brands got most right was when he called it the axis of aggression. And that's, you know, that's really what this is. I mean, it's authoritarianism that is aggressive and seeks to change the status quo. I mean, there's really no question about that. Russia's long wanted that, and so has China. And he also makes a good point that I don't know if he necessarily believes it will happen, but he posited that Russia and China could work together to use nuclear coercion against the United States, which is what you and I both think has a high probability of likelihood, is that they will work collaboratively together. And so, of course, what advocates of nuclear disarmament would say is that, well, if the United States builds a comparable capability, as you and I have advocated in our dynamic parity report, that each country individually will see this as, the pursuit of American nuclear superiority. Yeah. Now, I don't think this is as problematic as people suggest, because the way you design and field an arsenal means that you can very clearly signal to your adversaries who you're targeting. So, for example, if you were to have, Pershing 3, and you were to put Pershing 3 in the Pacific, it very clearly wouldn't have the range to strike Russian targets. Or if you put, if you put ICBMs, and ICBMs don't necessarily all have to have the exact same range, you could put ICBMs on the West Coast that are specifically targeted at China. There are things you can do to signal to an adversary, hey, these capabilities that I'm building are not targeted at you.
They are targeted at you.
Yes, exactly. Or you put slick them in. There's all sorts of things that you can do for the U.S. to effectively build parity that, particularly with ICBMs, that or you can do this with hypersonic weapons as well, that they're not targeted at Russia, but are targeted at China or vice versa. And so I don't see this as problematic. We're not trading off. And this is part of the problem that I see, is that the expectation is that if the advocates of modernization and expansion, if your solution isn't a perfect solution, then it's a failed solution. But my solution, the disarmament community, is perfect because yours is not perfect, or mine is acceptable, because so they don't put their own solutions through the same critical analysis that they like to put our solutions through. So there is no perfect solution either that we posit or that they posit. But what I would posit is the 50% plus one solution is expansion, because that's an option that is less bad than doing nothing or maintaining the status quo. Maintaining the status quo is far more dangerous than expansion. And that's sort of the double standard in this, is that for the disarmament community that criticizes Golden Dome, that criticizes expansion, they don't have a solution that's better.
That's right. That's right. And so, I think that's a great answer, actually, as well as to five, because as you said, the status quo is, it may not necessarily be deemed as working in some of these aspects. You mentioned hypersonics, so that kind of takes us to the second item here, which is that new tech can make deterrence more tenuous. I think this is especially true when we're thinking about this compression. We talk about attack time compression in some of our past articles, Adam. And when we're talking about when technology increases speed, lethality, and ambiguity of direction, it makes things much less predictable and much more dangerous, and therefore more prone to being destabilizing. Now, this isn't to say that that there isn't a lot of technology that can be used to increase defense. Golden Dome, you mentioned, sure, would be the application of a lot of new technology that would include defense. Take AI, for example. Using AI to create an offensive cyber weapon feels very destabilizing, but I can use the same AI to create a defensive system that would be theoretically much more stabilizing. So it all depends on what it goes to, which is the last thing that I would say in the risk here, which is not mentioned or called out in the article, but is it is the lack of ethics when applying technology. When you're using technology for defense and or deterrence, you're trying to protect and save lives and protect sovereignty. When you're using it for offensive systems and war making, if you will, now I think you're getting into the idea of I'm trying to kill more people faster, and I'm trying to do it so that they can't provide any sort of defense in that regard. And I would say that those aren't the items that are driven by American technology. When we look at hypersonic glide vehicles, fractional orbital bombardment systems, of which the DIA is now predicting China will have 60 of these in the next decade or two. These underwater torpedoes with huge megaton weapons, these are not weapons of deterrence. These are weapons, these are first strike weapons to make war. And so we need to understand when we're, especially to the point of the disarming advocates, you got to look at the ethics and start there first. Get after the bad guys, so to speak, who are building weapons not to defend and deter. They are building weapons to strike first.
Yeah, I guess my only sort of pushback on that would be that, you know, I'm not sure I ever see, you know, the idea of ethics being relevant to warfare or to weapons themselves. You know, we have the law of armed conflict and we have the Geneva Conventions. But if you go back in time, for example, and you look at, you know, the Mongols and how they fought, they would literally go to a city and kill everybody, save a few people, send them to the next city and say, if you capitulate, nothing will happen. You'll pay, you know, an annual tribute, but nobody dies. And they would actually do that. And, you know, in the end, if you look at the way we fight today, we fight a war where we drag wars out. That's and right. Over the longer course of that war, more people die and there is more suffering. And so the concept of ethics to me is problematic, because ethics oftentimes makes wars more protracted and prolonged and cause more harm. And I'm not sure that we're better off, but we get to feel good about the fact that, you know, we wanted to do well, even though we caused greater harm. And so with nuclear weapons, like anything else, I'm not sure that, you know, that what we think of as ethical is actually a better course of action and is better for the, you know, for civilian populations who may be harmed. It may protract the suffering and kill more people in the long run.
Well, I think this gets to, you know, sort of what was it, Sherman's march to Atlanta, you know, total war.
Exactly.
If we want to end this war quickly, we have to be as destructive as possible so that they will break their will to fight. Whereas we struggle all through global war and terror to build small diameter bombs to minimize collateral damage, and that war lasts 20 plus years. So I get your point, but in today's politics, we have President Trump who is screaming about Putin's attacking of civilians with hypersonic and cruise missile systems, this massive infusion of UAVs and other drone systems ranging from very small to very large, and whether they're attacking Israel or attacking an individual soldier in the Eastern Donbass, it is terror nonetheless, and it has changed the character of war, conventional war. It has not yet changed the character of nuclear war, although I think that could happen in the idea that if we start nuclear arming drones or cruise missiles or hypersonic glide vehicles, by the way, which we do believe Russia is doing with regard to some of their hypersonic systems. Fascinating. Let's go on to the third one, and that is the arms control question is no longer what did he say here? Arms control, the existing arms control architecture is crumbling. Well, yes, it is. And this is, I think, is because arms control is no longer meeting the needs of the great power rivals.
My question, though, is he says it was really good and that it was successful and it created stability.
Yes.
I'm not sure it was ever quite as relevant as he seems to suggest it was.
Yeah.
I mean, countries do what's in their own interest. And for the Russians, they engaged in arms control when they thought it was in their interest and when they thought they would get more out of it. We have historically always gotten less out of arms control. The only arms control agreement I would say we sort of, if you want to call it, we won it, would be the Intermediate Nuclear Forces Treaty, because we gave up a lot less than the Russians did, but we were able to hold them at risk in a way they were not able to hold us at risk. And so they, you know, they agreed to the treaty. So in the end, if you want to think of, you know, who would have destroyed whom, you know, perhaps we gave up more. But, you know, let's not forget that every single treaty the Russians have ever signed, they've cheated on. So I'm not exactly sure that, you know, at least now without arms control and with New START expiring, at least we'll know where we stand. And, you know, the arms control community won't be able to say, oh, well, there's a treaty, and then just blindly watch as the Russians, you know, cheat, because they've cheated on the Chemical Weapons Convention, the biological weapons. I mean, what have they not cheated on? And what have they not used to their advantage? So for me, I would submit that they've probably already taken steps towards a breakout of New START, and they know what we can see, and so they're doing things that we can't see. And just like, you know, with the assumption that CPRI and FAS and Hans Christensen and others, they have always underreported Chinese numbers. The reality is we don't know. We don't know their strategic numbers. We've never known their strategic numbers. We've always had to use how much plutonium we think they have for pits to try to guess at what we think the numbers are. But they probably have far more tactical nuclear weapons than we've ever estimated. Mm-hmm. They probably had far more strategic nuclear weapons. We've looked at silos to try to guess, but we don't know how many warheads are on each weapon. There's so much unknown unknowns when it comes to China that our estimates are just blind estimates. They have very little information. I mean, there is some information that we can guess at, but we cannot say with high probability that, you know, the Russia or the Chinese had 200 nuclear weapons in 2020. That's just garbage. That's a, you know, sort of a wag at best. So, I don't know if arms control matters.
I don't think it does. And I would argue, you know, the first detection of the violation of the INF was under the Obama administration. And after several years of trying to bring them in line and arguing with them about it, President Trump in his first term withdrew. I would also point out that the ABM treaty, which was arguably working pretty well, was withdrawn by the Bush administration in an effort to deal with the rogue states, specifically North Korea. So I think nations treaties have to continue to serve the national interests and the security needs of nations, because if it doesn't, they will either cheat or withdraw. And with regard to getting these folks into new treaties, I would argue that, my pro arms control friends out there, your adversary does not fear the United States. It does not fear America's nuclear arsenal specifically. Okay, and so why? What's their motivation, right? To bargain.
What's their self-interest?
That's right.
What is their national interest?
Right, to try to enter into a bargain that constrains America when we're so willing to constrain ourselves already. So there is no motivation for them to join a treaty because of fear that they need to constrain us. We've shown no proclivity to being being unrestrained or not constraining ourselves. There's just not an interest in this country to grow our nuclear arsenal in a significant manner. And so this is a challenge. And this goes to our fourth item that was on Dr. Brand's list, which is that the non-proliferation regime is being strained. Now, I think he argues for the most part here is that it's being constrained because our allies don't trust us, that they are losing some idea that we'll be there for them. I have a counter argument to this completely. And I simply believe that states seek to proliferate nuclear weapons because they feel they must in order to survive. Whether you're Iran or South Korea or Pakistan, you are going to proliferate because you feel it is an existential necessity. All right. And so I would argue that Western allies who are interested in proliferation isn't because they don't trust America's resolve or commitment to them. I think it's because they have watched America abandon its nuclear extended deterrent obligation for decades, and it is watching.
Decades. That's the key. Is it's decades,
yes. And it is watching a modernization program. As you and I have said before, we are 15 years into a 30-year modernization program, and I don't still think we have any new metal on the flight line or any new metal in a silo. And apparently, we now need new silos. So we are not showing our allies that we're committed to maintaining a capability and capacity sufficient enough to assure them. It is not because we're unwilling to go there. We'll shoot bullets and artillery pieces on their behalf all day long. But we're probably got a little bit of a challenge for them in convincing them on this whole nuclear issue. And I think that's becoming harder and harder. Arms control advocates, if you don't want to see more proliferation, you should come on our side and encourage more American nukes to safeguard those nations, and then they won't proliferate. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, and this goes to sort of the fifth point, which is about the political component and the criticism of Donald Trump. And so what I would submit to you is that, you know, the Beltway elites who have been making foreign policy and defense policy over the last 30 years, since, let's say, since 1991, 35 years, that those folks have abjectly failed. They thought that they could, if they were panda huggers, that they would never have to be panda sluggers. Mm-hmm. And now we know that, you know, China is not going to rise peacefully and become a democracy. They thought that we could, you know, that Russia would become more peaceful. They were wrong. Look at the wars we've engaged in since 1991. We've never achieved our objectives in any of them. Yeah. And, you know, part of this has me thinking about this is I'm reading Dereliction of Duty, which is, you know, H.R. McMaster's mm-hmm. book about the failures of Vietnam. And it was that war was a failure because you had civilian intellectuals and civilian political leaders who completely dismissed the advice of the military leadership. They did. And because they thought they were smarter, that they were the ones who knew best. And of course, you know, if you looked at those guys, they all had either none or very little military background. And that problem has only gotten worse, you know, since then. So if you look at a lot of these intellectuals today, they have no background. They don't know war because they've never fought them. And right. So what you're getting is you're getting a Beltway elite who believes that they and their wisdom know how to solve the problem. But the reality is they've been trying to do that and they've abjectly failed. So what do you do now? When the last 35 years you have failed to make American leadership successful, mm-hmm. what do you do now? Well, you blame Donald Trump. You say it was Donald Trump's fault. So while you failed over the last 35 years, you advocated drawdowns in the military. You advocated, you know, 95% reductions in the size of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. You killed the defense industrial base. And then now you're finding yourself in a world where you need all those things. Well, who was the one that put us in this position now?
That's right.
But yet somehow it's Donald Trump's fault. Because Donald Trump is now dealing with a world in which he needs the Europeans to support their own defense.
That's right. That's right. I want to call out a quote here from Dr. Brands in his piece here. He says, which I found quite shocking. But anyway, he says, quote, dozens of free world countries have bestowed the ultimate trust upon the American president by effectively granting him responsibility to make life or death decisions about using nuclear weapons on their behalf, unquote. Now, I think this is a fallacy. I don't think that there are any nations out there who have bestowed trust upon the American president to use a nuke on their behalf. I think they think that they're assured by the resolve that we might. Strategic ambiguity plays a role in this. But this is really a fallacy because this is really about the free riding aspect of which our allies have all but admitted with regard to our nuclear power. And so simply now what's being done is we're asking them to pay more for their own defense. And I'm not sure that these super close friends that we're so caring of and allied to and friends with, and I'm not disputing those things, but if we have that kind of relationship with them, then why do these calls to ask them to pay their fair share, so to speak, to use the President Biden vernacular, be met with such irascible opposition? It just seems awfully odd to me. And let me bring here, there are no plans to defund NATO with regards to American forces. You know, we recently lost a few troops there in the Baltics during an exercise, unfortunately. There's a large commitment. We've talked about on a past podcast about Secretary of State Rubio's very vocal commitment to NATO on behalf of President Trump. And let me remind Dr. Brands, who may not have seen this poll, there was a poll that was done. Where do Western Europeans stand on nuclear weapons? This was published by Euronews. And it basically comes out and says that the majority of Europeans in almost every country polled, they didn't get the Eastern European NATO countries. They only polled the Western European NATO countries, all of them were less than 50% in supporting American nuclear weapons in Europe. And the only numbers that were higher than 50% were the nations, Britain and France, who already have their nuclear weapons. And when polled about whether or not they should keep their own nuclear weapons, they did manage to pull a slightly over 50% margin. NATO does not care about at least the populations of NATO do not care about nuclear weapons or America's nuclear deterrence. They are not afraid of Putin and using his nuclear weapons, if you believe this poll. And so I'm not sure that the quote that I read you actually plays a role. And if it did, this should be a major election talking point in America's presidential elections. And this is rarely talked about, if ever, with regard to what we will do for other countries regarding nuclear weapons. What say you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point that we could probably discuss. We have discussed it in the past, and we could discuss it further here. But, you know, the unfortunate thing is we are running out of time.
And so, that's a get out of jail free card, Adam.
So we're going to unfortunately have to wrap up the podcast. That's a great thing about, you know, these discussions is that you can go on and on and on.
You can.
And
you
I'm
can.
Sure some of the listeners are like, you know, they wish they could jump in. Unfortunately, we're going to have to wrap it up.
As we're wrapping up, I just want to commend our readers to go find this article by Dr. Brands. It's published in Bloomberg News, The New Nuclear Age. It's even more chaotic. There are a lot of good points. We did sort of pick on the stuff we disagreed with to make this conversation a little more interesting. I don't always agree with everything Dr. Brands puts out there, but his intellectual concepts are fascinating to me, and I'm always interested in sharing it with our audience.
All right. Well, Curtis, thanks again. It was a great, great discussion. Of course, thanks to you, the listeners. Make sure I just saw the draft of our new report that Chris Stone has put together on GPS and how do we defend and deter our ability to essentially maintain a modern society, because GPS is, you know, electricity, the banking system. It all works on GPS. So that report will be coming out. Yeah, exactly. That report will be coming soon. We've got one report that will be out this summer on what we think an NPR should look like. We've got a report coming out on why we need ICBMs. So be looking for that. You need to check out our HUSC events. Go to the website, sign up. Of course, Global Security Review. Keep reading. There's lots of articles coming out. So there's a lot to see. So keep engaged, stay engaged with NIDS. We're working hard to make sure that we keep you entertained at least, and hopefully informed. Yeah, exactly. So, and as always, you know, we sign off every podcast by reminding you to always think deterrence.
Thank you for listening to the NIDS View. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength and our national deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I would like to thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative The NIDS View.
The NIDS Podcasting Network.